Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Sydney Mechanics School of Arts. For those people that can't see me over there, I'm Sophie, so I look after the marketing events and membership here at SMSA, and outside you've met the lovely Maddie, who helps me behind the scenes. Thank you all for coming out on this very, very frosty Thursday. Appreciate you being here, and if it's your first visit, welcome. So before we open today's conversation, I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the Gadigal people, who are the traditional custodians of the land on which we gather. We honour their unbroken connection to this place, their stories, their knowledge, their resistance, and we pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. For over 60,000 years, this has been the land of stories, spoken and sung, etched into rock, and woven through country, passed from generation to generation. So as we gather today to share stories of our own, may we do so with reverence for the oldest storytellers, and may their legacy remind us that stories shape not just who we are, but the world we live in. Some quick housekeeping before we welcome our guests. If you haven't done so, please do turn off your phones or switch them to silent. I promise there's nothing worse than having the collective judgment of 20 pairs of eyes swiveling towards you in slow motion. The toilets are outside the doors and stage right. There will be a Q&A at the end of the talk, so please raise your hand and we'll come over with a microphone. And after the event, our friends from Abby's bookstore will be outside. Books will be available for purchase and Suzanne will be signing. It's a great opportunity to support our author today and take a story home with you. So today we are joined by two guests whose name you surely recognise. Suzanne Leal is a novelist who doesn't shy away from life's complexities. Her stories take us into moral grey zones, whether it's schoolyards or courtrooms, exploring secrets that ripple through communities and families. Suzanne has a background in criminal, refugee, and guardianship law, and she writes with a clear-eyed compassion and a sharp sense of justice. Her books explore vulnerability not as a weakness, but as something deeply human, and in doing so, she gives a voice to the silenced and shines a light into the shadows. Joining her in conversation today is James O'Loughlin, a man with so many titles he may need a separate bookshelf just for his career. Lawyer, comedian, radio host, TV presenter, innovation expert, public speaker, and of course, author. You may recognise James from New Inventors on ABC, or be familiar with the sound of his voice from his appearances on ABC Radio. He is one of those rare and wonderful people who can talk easily about big ideas, innovation, storytelling, survival, with wit, wisdom, and a perfectly timed singer. So today's conversation is going to centre on Suzanne's new young adult novel, The Year We Escaped. It's an immersive read set in 1940s France and Germany, a tale of friendship, flight, and hope, and follows four young people navigating a world collapsing around them. I think young adult fiction is incredibly important because it invites younger generations to bear witness, to ask questions, and to understand viscerally what can happen when hatred goes unchecked and power is used without conscience. Crucially, it provides young readers with a framework for understanding the world and their place in it. And right now, as we witness the rise of fascism, political unrest, and unspeakable violence across the globe, books like The Year We Escaped offer more than history lessons. They become tools for empathy. They can show us what happens when we stop listening, when prejudice is allowed to fester, and when humanity is stripped away. And they remind us that silence and apathy are never neutral. So while this is a work of fiction, it ensures that we do not forget, that we keep that lantern of hope burning, and we keep the stories and memories alive, not through dates and statistics, but through faces and beating hearts. So please join me in giving a very warm welcome to Suzanne and James.
Thank you very much. That was such a good intro. I would think that's almost the best intro that I've ever heard, particularly one involving me. So if anyone's confused, I'm James, this is Suzanne. And last year when I had this book, crime novel Liars, come out, Suzanne interviewed me not once but twice, and each time at the start she said the same thing. She got this fierce look on her face and she said, look, I know you do things, you know you do interviews and stuff, but just so you understand, today I'm in control. I'm running the show. So, today, I'm in control. I'm running the show.
How does it feel, James? It feel better?
The power, the shoes on the other foot. So as you heard, this is a book Suzanne's written for children, although I have to say I started reading it at 8 a.m. last Saturday, and by 3 p.m. I'd finished it. I couldn't put it down. It's fantastic. It's set in the Second World War, and it's about four Jewish children, two who live in Germany, two who live in France, and all four of them end in an internment camp in France. And it's a fascinating book, and I'm really looking forward to hearing more from Suzanne about it. Why this story?
Why this story? I think the Second World War never quite ends in terms of what we think about and what we find out about it. And even though it's been a long time past now, new stories keep coming up. And for me, I think moving from the horror of the concentration camps to France and discovering a camp called Gurs, where life wasn't great, but it wasn't a matter of complete survival at someone else's whim, I just thought was a gentler way to introduce kids to the Second World War, particularly in these times.
Maybe just the mic a little bit further away. Luckily you didn't say any words with P's in them then, but they would have popped.
Try and avoid P.
And is it right you're drawn to the Second World War in particular because not only do so many extraordinary events happen and horrifying events, but there are so many situations where so many people are put in positions of moral complexity and have to ask, what the hell do I do?
I think so. I think the interesting thing is that James and I first met each other either at uni or when we were both at the Legal Aid Commission in criminal law. And I think one of the interesting things for people who go from law to writing is the criminal law is filled with that moral complexity. And I found, I don't know about you, James, but dealing with murder always scared me a bit because it's quite close, potentially. Yeah, right. Because often it's people who lose control, not so much planned. It's a issue of communication. And I always wonder, if I were put in that same position, how would I react? And I think by analogy with the Second World War, I studied German at university, and I always think, who would I have been in that time? Who would I have been born as? How would I have behaved? And would I have had resilience or courage? Would I have just kept my head down? How much can you manage? And I think you know, when you've got a head that keeps on going, sometimes rather than asking other people that question, you just got to write it down and solve it yourself.
Mm. Well, I can guarantee if I were to ask you all what's your favourite five books, none of them would be about a guy who had a really good life and things went smoothly, because that's boring in a story. So you're looking almost deliberately in searching for this story for the grey areas of morality, for when people are tested and challenged.
And I think also what's a bit of a challenge with the Second World War, particularly when writing for kids, is that, as I understand it, a lot of kids, like I'm thinking, you know, maybe 9 to 13, don't know a lot about the war. And I think if you don't know a lot about the war, you can't really understand today and where we've come from. But at the same time, kids have got a lot to deal with. I mean, there's a lot of social media, the world itself. And so what I wanted to do was give an escape, like literally an escape into a book, which makes it an adventure story more than didactic. I really hate being didactic. And I think what the war offers in this particular bit is that children can have autonomy in places where they often don't. And despite all the horror, there's a lot of adventure to be had, and there's a lot of resilience to be shown, and a lot of autonomy.
So maybe before we talk a bit more about some of those issues, flesh out the story a bit more. We've heard a skeleton. Flesh it out a bit more, yeah. Particularly the start.
Yeah, great. So look, it started upside down, really. I listened to an interview with Peter Gross, who wrote a book about a Protestant community in France who gave refuge to a whole lot of Jewish kids. And it's been written about a fair bit in French, a little bit over the years in English, but not much, and not much for kids. And that's what I was going to do. And then I thought, well, where do these kids come from? Who were they? And how did it all start? And for me, I just think if I'm given a story, I need to know its beginning. I don't like to come halfway. So I thought there's going to be a group of kids. 13 is a good age. My daughter's 13, so I know it a little bit. It's an age between being a child and coming towards adulthood, but not really being able to deal with it yet. And I wanted two girls, friends from Germany, who were brought to France. And then I wanted two boys who were brothers who were in Paris. And I think one of the frightening things when I was writing the book was writing about the disbelief in France, you know, that sort of quasi, I won't say arrogance, but just disbelief that anybody could come into Paris or into France. And so I wanted to look at how the French were just completely gobsmacked and how Hitler had been a bit of a clown for a lot of people. And perhaps we're seeing something of that behaviour even today, and I think the danger is in the clown that gets power.
Yeah, yeah. And so how did you go about, you know, your research? And I guess the preliminary question is, how much did you care about getting the facts right? Because it's a novel, right? You don't have to. How deep did that go? Yes, it was the Second World War. Yes, there were internment camps. Yes, kids went to them. But how far further than that did you go?
Yeah, look, I think one of the issues is because I've written a few books about the war focused on, to a large extent, the Jewish experience without being Jewish, I think that brings with it a real obligation to make sure it's right. One of my friends, a bloke called Bram Presser, said that if you write about the war, even if something didn't happen, it need to have been able to happen within the context. So I've read books where camps have been made up, and I feel a little bit uneasy about that. So, yeah, it seems easy just to sort of write a thinnish book, but by the time you put the geography together and you put the history together and you make it something that could have happened. So I think the answer is that because I'm not a real history buff, I like the creative force. I had to work harder at that and then had to take it out again to make more of the adventure, I think.
Yeah. So you have to know it and then chuck it away.
You have to know it and then know what you need and then close your eyes and say that's not got a job. And it doesn't matter if the readers don't know how much I studied for it. Mm. It just doesn't have a role there.
One of the great things about having setting a book in the Second World War and having the protagonists' kids is that it kind of is a barrier against the book being bleak because kids don't know the whole story. They don't really know geopolitical strategy and movements. They're really adaptable. They're curious, and whereas if you wrote it from an adult's point of view, basically they'd just be freaking out and worrying all the time. You get that lovely, oh, we're going somewhere new, even when this somewhere new is an internment camp.
Yeah, I think part of that's a responsibility thing, isn't it, that as an adult, there's all this weight of responsibility. You're the ones making the decision, which is why maybe a lot of people do read kids' books or YA books, because for a while you can take away that responsibility and just watch the dancing. So, I like things from a kid's perspective because they're interested in stuff that we might not say. So in one of these camps, the toilets are really awful but also really interesting because you've got to go up, there's no privacy, and then all the excrement has to be taken away, which sounds awful and probably shouldn't take this much conversation. But for kids, it's pretty fascinating. And just the mechanisms of things. And I suppose what I was doing is the microcosm within this great big heaving world, like the mud. How do you get through the mud? Who do you meet there? What do you do? How do you grow up?
Mm, yeah, you make all the little pieces of the book, the train trip, the going to the camp, little other things. You make them all really, really interesting. How do you do that? How do you make a train trip interesting?
How do you make a train trip interesting? I think you – I'm not really into those journey books where you start at A and you go to B, and so strangely I suppose that's what I've written. I think what you do is you see it in your head and you focus on a couple of people who you like, and also I think you don't know what's happening, and particularly in the Second World War when there's a train, I mean there's no control, and I think maybe it's a suspense. You've got to keep suspense somehow, even in the small areas, and I think being in a train you haven't chosen to be on, going to a place you don't know, that keeps the rhythm of it going.
We've talked about ethics and morality in the Second World War, and we've talked about train trips, and we've talked about suspense, and one way in which you combine them all is to have this lovely little moment where they're getting shipped out of Germany, the mother and her daughter, and the mother's been smart enough to bring all this food with her, but no one else has got food, and there's this really, and they don't know where they're going really, and they don't know when they're going to next get a meal, and so the dilemma for the mother is, these people are in the same situation as me. Do I share the food or do I keep it for me and my daughter? And it's a really interesting dilemma. And the daughter is like, what's she sharing the bloody food for? Like, it's all we've got. And I reckon I would have been like, you can't read that without thinking, what would you do in that situation? I definitely would have ordered it. But it's a great dilemma and a very real one. I'm sure it must have happened hundreds of times.
I think it sort of speaks to the people I've surrounded myself with over the last little while. So this is a story that won't be immediately relevant, but can you bear with it? So my husband, David, is a very even, good-natured soul, and we had a child, like we had a girl after I'd had three boys, and we had to buy a new car because there are six of us, not five of us. So stupidly, we took all four kids to the car dealers to buy this. I know, including the baby who was like 9 or 10 months or something, yeah. And we had no idea what we were doing. And the car dealer sat us down and he said, "Okay, I'm going to give you my best offer, and then you give me your best offer, okay?" I'm like, all right, the baby's crying and David's like, yeah, good, okay. So he says, if you like, you can just slip a note between each other so you know what your best offer is when I'm giving my best offer. So I'm like, okay. And I think it was something like $28,000 was his best offer. So I'm thinking, okay, 26. So we swapped notes, David and I. He said 32. And I said 26. So he's the sort of person that always ups higher. And I think
you knew at this point the 28,000 offer?
Yes.
So he was offering more than
he was offering more. Right. It's just a factor of his personality. And I think the sharing food I'm more like the daughter, I think. I'll be the hoarder. And I think, like, when I was 10, I remember I had this birthday party and we had it outside and there were prizes, which was great, except my mother had organised that the prizes were you'd get money that you could then donate to your favourite charity. And I remember being mortified.
But a great thing about your book, and I think you've made this point, is that you can sit here and say, yeah, I'd hold the food, I'd share it, but no one knows until they're in that position. And the great thing about your novel and, you know, other novels like it is they put you in that position and it's as close as you can get without actually being there to having to make that decision, isn't it?
And I think, and it's the same with your work, James, as well, I think just saying, look, this is what it is. This is a situation that I've made. What do you think? Rather than I'm going to tell you what to think. I think that there's a lot of didactic stuff, a lot of being told what to think. And I just think if we're to have any escape or any refuge from this noisy world, it needs to be giving the reader some autonomy and letting it become their story rather than what I want for them. Is that how you work as well?
Yeah, it is. You know, when you're starting to write, you read those things and you read people saying, oh, yeah, the characters just tell me what to do, and you're struggling with someone called Mary and you have no idea who she is or what she's saying. You just say, piss off, that's ridiculous. And then one day, if you're lucky, it does kind of happen sometimes. And it's not as if the book writes itself, Joe Biden auto-pen style, but you're out of the way then. And that is good. It means you've constructed something real. And sometimes, occasionally, I've had it with this book, which is about three people who become criminals. I found it hard to say goodbye to them. And I thought, you're an idiot, James. They're just scribbles on a page, but they felt real to me. Do you get that?
Yeah, I think what's underplayed, as you said as well, is that it's just hard yakka, a lot of it. A lot of it is hard, and sometimes it doesn't work and the characters don't work, but something is better than nothing. And I think it's from the something that things improve. So I don't like the first draft because it's just like trying to make this story from nothing. But then once it's there and you think, okay, I didn't think I could do that, but I've done it, then the second draft is much easier.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it helps with confidence.
Definitely. It's easier to make a good paragraph out of a bad paragraph than it is to make a good paragraph out of nothing.
Exactly.
So if you get a bad paragraph, then a good paragraph isn't that far away. But from a big wall of blankness, if you think, what I've got to write is a good paragraph, it's just paralysing. You just try and write some crap and then gradually herd it into being something gradually better. Thank God that wasn't only me. Do you think there are people, there must have been, you know, people like Dickens and whatever and Jane Austen, because they couldn't retype it, you know, rewriting it all was a huge logistical problem, whereas we can just tap, 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 make a little better. There must be some people that just, the gold comes out on the first draft.
I wonder, although maybe there's just a lot more longhand redoing it.
In the fireplace.
God, and just getting rid of it. I think what's interesting is to give yourself permission not to be great.
Yes.
And I think I know a lot of people who want to write a book and a lot of really cleverer people than I am, but often their demands on themselves are so great that, like you said, they're going to be paralysed before they allow themselves to put on paper stuff that's not quite good enough. So I think for me it's giving yourself the right to be mediocre, to be bad, at least at first, and then move from there.
Yeah. I also think people put too many demands on themselves quality-wise, as you said, but not enough demands on themselves quantity-wise. That is, I'll write when I feel like it, I'll write when I've got something to good. Like if you just say to yourself, if you have an hour a day, say you had that, okay, an hour a day. then eventually by the end of the year you have a book, or well, maybe 2 years with now a day. But you know, you will have a book. Whereas some people get so freaked out by the fact that the first paragraph is awful that that's their day done, and that's you know, they're 57 minutes short because they freak themselves out. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think it's a weird career or job to have when you've got to be pedantic in a lot of ways, because you've got to research and you've got to get the words right, but you've got to let them go at the same time. So it's always that juggling between two parts of the brain, the brain that will let it go and the brain that needs to check it up. So
yeah.
I think it's the same as you. I'm happiest, I think, when I've got a structure that allows me to write for 2 hours, maybe 3 hours in the morning, every morning, and then finish, and you just do the time, and it might not be great, but you're not the judge of that. You're just getting the content out.
Yeah, right. What time?
Oh, you know, nothing exciting because I've got the 13-year-old, but maybe if I'm not working, 9 to 12.
9 to 12.
Yeah. And then if sometimes you can keep going, but if you just say to yourself, it's just this time, then it's not.
Yeah.
It doesn't loom. How do you do it?
Well, can I ask one more first? Word target?
Sure. No.
No. Yeah, no, I'm with you. If I don't have anything else on, then I'll try and do, maybe 8 to 11, then have a break, then do a bit more. And I can feel through the day, if you go into the afternoon, my productivity going down and down. Mm-hmm. The first hours are always the better. But I can ride on planes and in the back of taxis and on the train, like just snatching little bits of time. And I think if one thing I've got better at, and it's being, a bit kinder to myself and a bit less, as you were saying, that's a crap sentence, just accepting it will be crap.
Yeah, but it's there. And I think also not thinking too much ahead of the games. So I used to think when I was doing law, when I was doing criminal law, that when someone's been arrested, you don't want them to go too far in terms of their thoughts. So rather than thinking, who's going to visit me when I'm in jail, you think, you go to bail. So there's a bail application to be made, and then we'll make the next decision. And for me, I've always thought it's like, don't work out what knickers you're going to wear to your new job until you've got the new job. And I think it's the same with writing, and that you're not writing for the bookshelves as you keep going. I mean, you've got to be a bit mad, I think, to write, because it's I don't know about you, James, but it's not the best business proposition.
And oh, that's terrible. Yeah.
So and my agent always says that writers are the diseased who need to be shepherded through this process. And I think if you've got to write, you've got to write. So you may as well just grit your teeth and get it going.
Well, can you expand on that? You've got to write, you've got to write. Like, you know, I've read people have said that, I have to write. Do you have to write?
Yeah, I feel a bit discombobulated if I
do.
Yeah, I feel like I think we're discouraged to think long and hard, because there's so much social media. I mean, even sometimes in decisions I'm writing, there's a clock where you've got to do it quickly. And I think sometimes just to give your brain a bit of slow thinking,
it's good for you.
Yeah, and I just need, if I've written for a couple of hours, everything's better. And I don't know why, but it is.
I know why.
Why?
Because, well, for me.
Yeah.
For me, because I feel like I've done something hard that it'd be easier not to, and I just feel, even if it's gone badly, I feel like I'm doing the thing I should be doing. I feel nourished, and I don't really care that much if no one ever sees it and it never comes to anything. I just think it's a good thing for me to have done, and I feel a little bit pleased with myself for having done it rather than watch telly.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? So it's like, and I always think to myself, well, if nothing comes of this, I could have watched telly and nothing would have come of that either, so yeah. We're sort of even. We're even Stevens. Nothing's lost.
If life is meaningless, you know. Why not? So when did you start writing? As a kid, or when did you first have a crack at a book? Tell us about that.
Yeah, like as a kid. So if you remember, I think you probably all have one teacher that you can think of who was just fabulous. One teacher who still makes you, or if you didn't, that's a shame. It's the first time I've got to. But look, I had in primary school two really good teachers and then two that I didn't like. And the difference between the two was that I liked was they just let me go. They just let me write as much as I wanted, whereas the ones that I didn't like as much made you write to a template and made you write, you know, all you were given were decisions to add a word here and there. So I think from year three I was encouraged to write and I liked to write. But then university for me, when I was studying literature, so French and German literature, sort of had the opposite effect. It drained the creativity rather than giving it. So I thought, you know, we had to criticise all these authors and we had to say, you know, where they'd done badly or what we didn't like. And it just made me think, well, if they can't get it right, what about me? So I think I needed to be well away from that literary criticism and that idea of universities being there to examine and analyse.
Me too.
Really? Exactly the same?
Exactly the same.
Yeah. So when did it happen? Later for you?
Yeah, I thought it. I used to love it at school when they give you a book and say, "What do you think of this book?" And it was just you and the book. But at uni, suddenly is, "What do you think of the modernist interpretation, the feminist interpretation, this interpretation, what this critic said?" And it just seemed like all we were doing was looking at critics of. We weren't really trying to having any relationship with the book, just critics. So I hated it. I had a crack in the 90s writing a crime novel and I reread some of it recently. It wasn't that bad, actually. It might get resurrected. And I actually stole a plot from a half-written book that's in Liars. I stole a subplot and it kind of worked.
Was it somebody else's book or yours?
No, it was my book. It was my book. I just never finished it. But I always wanted to. I always thought for me, because I was an only child and read books all the time, that the thing I should most aspire to in my life was to write a book. I thought two things. That would be my Everest, and I also thought with absolute certainty it would be too hard. So I didn't really have the guts to try a novel until, well, I tried one in the 90s, but to finish one, I finished my first one in 2012, and that was a kids' novel because I had kids at primary school at that point, and I thought they'd be a good test audience. Whereas you do things the other way. You wrote grown-up novels first. I know you got is it 12 or 13-year-old now, but most of your kids are almost grown or grown, and so you left writing kids' books to your kids who are almost out of the age group. What's going on there?
Yeah, look, I think sometimes it's more the story than making the decision. So the first one is Running with Ivan, and it came from an idea that I had years and years and years ago. And I always loved time travel. I think, you know, there's some fabulous time travel books, and it seemed, in retrospect, perhaps it would have been a good idea to do an adult book with time travel. Seems that's taking off.
Yeah, it could have been a good idea.
But for kids, I think time travel was exciting. So I think I wrote for the characters I had rather than for the audience I wanted.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. By the way, when you say I've always loved time travel, I presume you meant stories about time travel. You haven't done it.
Oh, well, you know, every now and then I do.
Yeah. How do you – this is a question I really want to know the answer to. So in The Year We Escaped, you have this thing where – I don't know, it's just so easy to keep reading. All my favourite authors have that. David Nichols, who's an English writer, you just keep reading and you're hardly aware. Even if not a lot's happening in his books, you just keep reading because it's just interesting being there. Another one's English comedian Mark Watson – and you've definitely got that in The Year We Escaped. Are you aware, were you aware of that? Is that conscious, or are you just happy at least one person thinks it?
Well, I'm happy. I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I'm happy one person, specifically you.
I'm sure there's lots, yeah.
But for the writers in the audience, I think what happens towards the end of the drafts is I get a rhythm going. It's almost like a musical rhythm, and the book needs to fit into the rhythm when I'm reading it aloud. And when I first did that, it seemed ridiculous, and I thought it'd turn out like Dr. Seuss. But there's something like there's something about a rhythm that I think stops a reader from stopping. So it makes your sentences clearer, it makes them shorter, and it just rides a bit, a little bit. I think that's what.
Right.
I think also clarity. My dad always said
clarity. Yeah.
Yeah. That if you can't say something simply, then you probably haven't understood it. So just trying to keep things a little bit pared back, but keeping the adventure and keeping the momentum.
Mm. And do you think consciously about the amount of description? Like if you say they got in a train. It's in Second World War. I'd have a vague image of that. You know, I wouldn't necessarily need you to tell me all about the train. But on the other hand, if you tell me about the train in kind of an interesting way, I'll be into it. I mean, how do you make those decisions?
I think you've got to see it. So I've not got – anyone who knows me knows I don't have a very good sense of geography or sense of direction. So I need to work hard at that. And so when you come into a train, for example – you do need to know what sort of train it was and what sort of train was around. So are there carriages, are there not? How many seats on either side? Because if you're doing a whole scene in it, then you need to be able to look at it. You almost need a map for it. So I think I do enough that's needed. And if I don't know, then I think the writing just doesn't sound as confident.
Yeah, right.
I think I need to know enough to sound authoritative.
Do you know what I like to see? Maybe AI can do it for me. Just take 20 of my favourite writers and ask and what percentage of their book is description. And I wonder how much it varies. I wonder if it all comes in at between 25 and 28% or something like 6% and something like 47% or something.
Yeah, look, I like dialogue. I think a lot of immersing yourself in a book is when people are talking to each other rather than and that shows you what's going on. I mean, it shows you a lot of what the person's like, and it shows the dynamic between the characters. So I find a dialogue easier than description, I think.
Yeah, me too.
You too?
Yeah. We're going to see if you guys have got any questions shortly. So, you know, prepare. What's there's certainly the potential for a sequel to The Year We Escaped. I want to find out more about these characters. Will there be one?
Look, I hope so. Like I said, I had this idea where they were going to start before the war and it would end after the war, and I thought, no big deal. But it's such a long time and such a lot happens. And
well, this is only over, is it a few months?
In the end, it's basically about a year and a bit.
Yeah, right.
So they end up seeking some refuge, but the place where they find refuge is really, really interesting in itself. Mm. It was a place where there was a really progressive school, where you're a little bit in a refuge because you were remote, and again, parents aren't there because the parents have been left behind. But for children, I mean, that's the Harry Potter scenario, isn't it? You're basically in a boarding school. You get to run your own race, more or less. And so I want to explore that. And then when, of course, the occupation of France took over, any refuges were gone. Mm. And so the next story is what happens. And what's really interesting, I think, is scouts. You know, when my sister-in-law met her husband, who's French, when he was coming out for a jamboree, like he was in his 20s and she was maybe 20, and I thought, why is this bloke still a scout at this age and sort of coming up for the jamboree?
Yeah.
And he's a great bloke, and I sort of thought about that for a bit, then forgot it. But the thing is, in France, the scouting movements were really, really important because there were different types of scouts. And the Jewish scouts, for example, when Paris was occupied and Jewish adults were being taken from their houses, sometimes the children would be left behind. And it would be the Jewish scouts who would go around and pick up the kids and try and find them somewhere else to live. And it was the scouts who lived near the mountains who knew the geography of the place. And you know how you're taught to use a compass, and there's always orientation, there's camping. So they actually knew the way across from France to Switzerland to neutral territory. And they had uniforms, and uniforms are a disguise. So there's one story where a number of scouts took to Switzerland from France some refugees, and they all just wore a scout uniform. I mean, some of them were very elderly, some of them were young, but and it finally clicked to me as to why there's a completely different sense of what scouting is in France than here. So I'd like to do that because I think that's interesting for kids as well, as to something that they know about what its origins has been elsewhere.
Yeah, yeah, nice, nice. And by the way, if you ever, Suzanne's touched on it, if you ever want to go writing a kid's book, pretty soon you'll realise one of the questions you have to answer is, how do I get rid of the parents? Now, you don't have to kill them, but you do have to get them out of the way. So Harry Potter is dead at the very start. Every other, Enid Blyton, every one of her books, children go out and play, father's in his study and don't disturb him. Because he's, who knows what he's doing, he might be dead. And I don't want to see you until dusk, right? So that's how Enid Blyton solved it. But because parents make decisions for children. So if you want the children to be autonomous, got to get rid of the parents. Yeah.
And you know, you want it to be exciting for them. So you want them to forget that you're an adult. I mean, this is their story. This is their adventure. And you know, like you said, so... you've got to try and work out what happens to the parents, and if they, in a Blyton, they're sort of there, but they're a little bit more transparent, although they're a little bit more shadowy.
Yeah, and particularly father in his study never comes out.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Any of you guys got any questions? Yes. Yeah, you, I reckon. Yeah.
Hi. Thank you, Suzanne. Have your children read the book, and what do they think? And especially the 13-year-old.
Okay. So for the first kid's one, Running with Ivan, which is my fifth book, my first son Alex reads them and gives me feedback, which is great. He's in his 20s. Dominic reads them. Xavier hasn't, so Alex, my first, paid him to read Running with Ivan. And look, quite frankly, Miranda's not that interested. So a lot of her friends have read particularly Running with Ivan, and they've really liked it. But I think there's something about a parent writing the book that it might be a little bit exciting to say, but it sort of takes the magic away. It's almost like you've seen the workings of it. And for a kid who's in that age group, maybe I'm just a bit too close to it.
So I wrote five kids' novels about between kind of 10 and 15 years ago when my kids were in primary school. And I used to read them the first draft before I sent it to the publisher. And I just used to assess when they're interested and when they're bored, and I would edit accordingly. And, you know, you go through all these phases when you're writing, and Tolkien used to spend 18 pages describing a forest. I'll spend 2 pages. I'll make a really interesting forest. Get 3 lines into reading the description of the forest. And my daughter Nina went, yeah, we get it. It's a forest. Like, we get it. Okay, can you get on with this? Like, we know what a forest is. We're not stupid. So I found their editing advice very helpful.
Yeah, I think I did more from the publisher's perspective, I think. I started the Running with Ivan about with a wedding, and it was quite, you know, a long wedding. I thought it was quite funny, quite good.
Yeah.
She said, kids aren't really interested in weddings, which is probably right.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, because the, you know, it goes around them. That's not really, there's not much to do for the kids unless they're dressed up and walking down an aisle, which is not much fun necessarily.
Yeah. So, well, actually, I want to ask you about that. Sorry, we'll get to you in a tick. So usually you send it to a publisher, then they send it back with some kind of big picture notes, then you send it in again, then they have some more kind of, you know, granular detailed notes, and then there's a third round as well. And for every note, you've got the opportunity to agree or disagree, to have an argument or a discussion, or just to accept it. And in my experience, you usually think they're wrong when you first read them. Then after a day or two, you realise they're right. That's my experience, and it's usually a pretty nice process. But what about you?
Oh, it depends. So for the adult books, there's a my most recent adult book is The Watchful Wife, and my publisher had said, oh, yeah, I think this is pretty clean now, which meant, you know, not much to do. And then when I got the structural edit document, it was 26 pages long.
Wow.
And you just think, I don't think I can do this. So you put it away and then you take it up again and you think, I've got to do it. And then you just go question by question by question. And soon enough, the pages go. But it can be quite sobering. On the other hand, these are clever, really specialised people whose job and who are paid to assess my imaginary and your imaginary worlds. And that's and when you're in your world and you're by yourself writing that, when suddenly you can have this conversation without being scheduled for it, it's with the editor themselves, it's fascinating because some...
Well, it feels like a privilege too.
Well, exactly. It's imagine spending this time with something that I've created and they're as interested in getting it right as I am without the same recognition.
Yeah.
That's what I find as well, that it's a job. Yeah, look, it's paid. I don't think publishing's paid so well, but the amount of interest and the amount of enthusiasm you get is terrific.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you find that as well? Do you accept stuff or do you mostly say?
Yeah, no, I know what you do. I never reply within 48 hours because I've got to, you know, accept it. You know, you've got to, like, my natural instinct is say, you're wrong, I'm right, but then after a day or two I realise they're right and I'm wrong.
You know what, I've heard that when writers get more and more famous, often some of them will accept editors' suggestions less, so the books get bigger because the editorial's acceptance gets smaller, or even, you know, if it's a new editor and a very well-known writer, perhaps there's a bit of reticence to do the edits. So I've always been interested in that.
Well, a classic example of that is big famous directors and their stupid three-hour movies that everyone's too scared to, you know, they're too scared to edit. And someone was saying actually, I can't remember who, some critic maybe, that it was an argument. So you know that one Francis Ford Coppola did himself, financed himself recently about an architect or something, they said it was a huge argument in favour of studio notes because he didn't have a studio, didn't have any notes, and they said it was ridiculously long. We're getting off books. Your question.
Thank you so much, Suzanne. That was great hearing about your process and yours too, James. Just a really simple question. How do you get inside the voice of a young person and the specifics of those kids being French, Jewish, German? What... I mean, how do you actually write from that voice, the dialogue?
I think I have in my head a child that would meet the criteria. So
a real person?
Yeah. So a little bit sometimes. So Rachel is based on one of my daughter's friends. And
does she know?
No. Nah. You know, she doesn't.
Not yet.
And I think the sibling rivalry between the two kids, that's pretty universal. So you've got a kid who's 13 and a sibling who's 9, then they're going to have similar sort of arguments that I had with my brother that my kids had between themselves. I think in terms of the timing of it, you've got to be careful with the language, I suppose. And I think to get that was from testimonies. So there's a lot of testimonies that have been written about the war and sometimes by children as well, or at least adults recalling their childhood. So I think it's a little bit, it can be hit and miss, but after a while I just imagine the scene playing out and the once you get just a little bit of a feel for the language, like I haven't tried too much to put the language completely in the times, because I think then you lose the attention of kids here. But just a couple of words like latrines and just words that were used at the time. So I think you just hope for the best, really.
One thing I really like is that the four kids are generally, they're nice to each other and they're nice to their parents. And so often these days it feels like, particularly when people get older, they think, I worked on a TV show once with a producers always say, oh, come on, you've got to make the kids fight more. You've got to make them be mean to each other and da-da-da, because that's how real families are. And I said, I don't want to do that. Like, you know, it's why can't they just be, you know, you want to be amusing and you want to be entertaining, but they don't have to be pulling each other's undies down, do they?
And I think when you got kids where, like, one of the girls, her mum's a single mum, so she's had more responsibility, so the relationship between the two of them is different for that reason. And I think in these times of great difficulty, the kids can't afford, no one can afford to fall apart if you're going to keep on going.
Yeah.
And, I do like a bit of a sibling scrap though.
Suzanne,
when you were preparing or writing, did you take into consideration or think about some of the criticism that was leveled at Heather Morris, the tattooist of Auschwitz, a non-Jew writing about a Jewish topic, Helen Signy, Maya's Last Dance, someone of Jewish descent but someone who's not Jewish writing about a Jewish subject? Did that come into play? Did that play on your mind? Did you think about that?
Interesting question.
Yeah. Look, it's a question that I've often thought about. I think particularly at the time, in the times now, where there is some school of thought that you only write what you are or what you know. I think the problem for me is that these stories are being lost. So people are dying, and it's very rare now that you'll get a testimony from people there at the time. And I think writing a book is hard and it takes a long time, and as we said, it's not a good business proposition. And sometimes you're the person that can do it of everyone around. So in the year we escaped, a lot of the research had to be done in French, and I speak French. And in earlier books it had to be done in German, and I studied German. And I think you've got to be very careful when you're not Jewish. On the other hand, and I found with earlier books, I got more honesty from people, because often in the Jewish generational issues, you've got the Holocaust survivor and you've got the children who are traumatized by that, and often the parents don't want to disclose too much for the children. When you're trusted, like I was with my old neighbour, Fred Perger, and Eva Perger, and they trust you but you're not of their blood, I think sometimes you get a more honest and a more detailed story. I think with all things, if you do it with goodwill and you do it with some intelligence and you do it with research, I have Jewish friends to read over the books beforehand. There's a sort of a sensitivity read. But I suppose I've decided I'd rather write the book than not have it written. And I'm happy to take the criticism. I've taken on board the criticism that's been levelled at the tattooist of Auschwitz, and I think that's why I said I try to make things possible and try to accept advice. So, for example, in Running with Ivan, I had one scene where my time traveller, not Jewish, not of the time, ends up in one of the in Auschwitz. And when Bram read that over, he said, "I feel really uncomfortable. I feel really uncomfortable about having a child who is not from that time and who is not Jewish being in this place." So it was almost like a sanctuary as well as a place of horror. And, you know, you don't want to be told to change a whole lot of stuff. But I thought, I don't understand that because I haven't lived through it or I haven't had relatives, but he does, and so I changed it. And there's always a way. There's always a way to go through it. And I think what's been I think what's been good for me is to have had the support of Shalom, of the Jewish Museum, and quite frankly, I think in the current times, it's probably not bad to have someone who's just a little bit on the edges and a little bit more of an observer talking about a time that was and letting people make their own conclusions from that.
That's a very good answer. That's a very good answer. I think there's a huge difference between the principle of write about what you know, which is a good starting point, and write only characters that are like you. I haven't read The Tattooist of Auschwitz, and I don't know anything about the controversy about it, so I'm not making any comments at all about that. But I don't want to just write middle-aged male characters. I've written six protagonists who are female, and I just tried to write them as people who are female. And one of the great things about writing and reading is you explore other people and other ways of being, and, you know, it'd be impossible to write a book, really, without... if you're only writing about people who are like you, that'd be very boring.
And I think just with the Heather Morris situation, I think it was a big surprise for her to have been so popular with that first book, and she'd sort of she'd straddled fiction and non-fiction, so she had a work of fiction but using real names, and in a way that sort of propelled her into the next book, where there is still the real names but a fictional story that became more fictional. And I wonder whether part of that was the most extraordinary success she had unexpectedly, and that if she'd had more forewarning, that might have been different. And I think that's probably a key between working out where your fiction and non-fiction is. So I try to make fictional characters rather than relying on non-fictional things. Because I think, but, you know, I think in the end, most people are trying their best with goodwill, and I think perhaps that's the starting point, and then you go from there.
Yeah, I mean, one of the great things about writing fiction as opposed to non-fiction is think, oh, I can't get in trouble, you know, it's all made up, and there you can. We're out of time.
Thank you.
Suzanne was wonderful. She'll be signing books in the foyer. There'll be a couple of mine too, but it's mainly Suzanne's. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much, James. Thank you, everybody. Thank you very much, Sophie.
Thank you.